Chapter 4. Was God an Astronaut? The Bible is full of secrets and contradictions. Genesis, for example, begins with the creation of the earth, which is reported with absolute geological accuracy. But how did the chronicler know that minerals preceded plants and plants preceded animals? And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness," we read in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Why does God speak in the plural? Why does he say us, not me? Why our and not my? One would think that the one and only God ought to address mankind in the singular, not in the plural. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 2. Who can tell us what sons of God took the daughters of men to wife? Ancient Israel had a single sacrosanct God. Where do the sons of God come from? There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. Once again we have the sons of God who interbreed with human beings. Here, too, we have the first mention of giants. Giants keep on cropping up in all parts of the globe, in the mythology of East and West, in the sagas of Tiahuanaco and the epics of the Eskimos. Giants haunt the pages of almost all ancient books. So they must have existed. What sort of creatures were they, these giants? Were they our forefathers who built the gigantic buildings and effortlessly manhandled the monoliths? Or were they technically skilled space travelers from another star? One thing is certain. The Bible speaks of giants and describes them as sons of God, and these sons of God breed with the daughters of men and multiply. We are given a very exciting and detailed account of the catastrophe of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis chapter 19, verses 1 through 28. Two angels came to Sodom in the evening when Father Lot was sitting near the town gate. Obviously, Lot was expecting these angels, who soon proved to be men, because he recognized them at once and hospitably invited them to spend the night in his house. The men of the town, says the Bible, wanted to know the strangers. But the two strangers were able to dispel the local playboy's sexual lust with a single gesture. They smote the mischief makers with blindness. According to Genesis chapter 19, verses 12 through 14, the angels told Lot to take his wife, sons, daughters, sons-in-law, and daughters-in-law out of the town with all speed, for they warned him it would be destroyed very soon. The family was unwilling to believe this strange warning and took the whole thing for one of Father Lot's bad jokes. And Genesis continues, "And when the morning arose, then the angels hastened Lot, saying, Arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters, which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city. And while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand, and upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him. And they brought him forth, and set him without the city. And it came to pass, when they had brought them forth abroad, that he said, Escape for thy life. Look not behind thee, neither stay thou in the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. Haste thee, escape thither, for I cannot do anything till thou be come thither." According to this report, there is no doubt that the two strangers, the angels, possessed a power unknown to the inhabitants. The suggestive urgency, the speed with which they drove the Lot family on, also makes us think. When Father Lot tarried, they pulled him along by the hands. They had to get away in a matter of minutes. Lot, they ordered, must go into the mountains, and he must not turn around. Nevertheless, Lot does not seem to have had unlimited respect for the angels, because he keeps on making objections. "I cannot escape to the mountain, lest some evil take me and I die." A little later, the angels say that they cannot do anything for him if he does not go with them. What actually happened at Sodom? We cannot imagine that Almighty God is tied down to a timetable. Then why were his angels in such a hurry? Or was the destruction of the city by some power or other fixed to the very minute? Had the countdown already begun, and did the angels know about it? In that case, the moment of destruction would obviously have been imminent. Was there no simpler method of bringing the Lot family to safety? Why did they have to go into the mountains at all costs? And why on earth should they be forbidden to look around again? Admittedly, these are awkward questions about a serious matter, but since the dropping of two atomic bombs on Japan, we know the kind of damage such bombs cause and that living creatures exposed to direct radiation die or become incurably ill. Let us imagine for a moment that Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed according to plan, that is, deliberately, by a nuclear explosion. Perhaps, let us speculate a little further, the angels simply wanted to destroy some dangerous fissionable material and at the same time to make sure of wiping out a human brood they found unpleasant. The time for the destruction was fixed. Those who were to escape it, such as the Lot family, had to stay a few miles from the center of the explosion in the mountains, for the rock faces would naturally absorb the powerful dangerous rays. And, we all know the story, Lot's wife turned around and looked straight at the atomic sun. Nowadays, no one is surprised that she fell dead on the spot. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire. And this is how the account of the catastrophe ends. Genesis chapter 19, verses 27 through 29. And Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord, and he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah, and toward all the land of the plain, and beheld, and lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. We may be as religious as our fathers, but we are certainly less credulous. With the best will in the world, we cannot imagine an omnipotent, ubiquitous, infinitely good God who is above all concepts of time and yet does not know what is going to happen. God created man and was satisfied with his work. However, he seems to have repented of his deed later because this same creator decided to destroy mankind. It is also difficult for enlightened children of this age to think of an infinitely good father who gives preference to favorite children, such as Lot's family, over countless others. The Old Testament gives some impressive descriptions in which God alone or his angels fly straight down from heaven, making a tremendous noise and issuing clouds of smoke. One of the most original descriptions of such incidents comes to us from the prophet Ezekiel. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the 4th month, in the 5th day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river of Chebar, that the heavens were opened, and I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof, as the color of amber, out of the midst of the fire. Also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. And every one had four faces, and every one had four wings, and their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. Ezekiel gives precise details of the landing of this vehicle. He describes a craft that comes from the north, emitting rays and gleaming and raising a gigantic cloud of desert sand. Now, the God of the Old Testament was supposed to be omnipotent. Then why does this Almighty God have to come hurtling up from a particular direction? Cannot he be anywhere he wants, without all this noise and fuss? Let us follow Ezekiel's eyewitness account a little further. Now as I beheld the living creatures, behold one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures, with his four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their work was like unto the color of a barrel, and they four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. When they went upon their four sides, and they turned not as they went. As for their rings, they were so high that they were dreadful, and their rings were full of eyes round about them four. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went by them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. The description is astonishingly good. Ezekiel says each wheel was in the middle of another one, an optical illusion. To our present way of thinking, what he saw was one of those special vehicles the Americans use in the desert and swampy terrain. Ezekiel observed that the wheels rose from the ground simultaneously with the winged creatures. He was quite right. Naturally, the wheels of a multipurpose vehicle, say an amphibious helicopter, do not stay on the ground when it takes off. More from Ezekiel. Son of man, stand upon thy feet, and I will speak unto thee. The narrator heard this voice and hid his face in the ground in fear and trembling. The strange apparitions addressed Ezekiel as son of man and wanted to talk to him. The account goes on. And I heard behind me a voice of a great rushing, saying, Blessed be the glory of the Lord from his place. I heard also the noise of the wings of the living creatures that touched one another, and the noise of the wheels over against them, and a noise of a great rushing. In addition to his precise description of the vehicle, Ezekiel also noted the noise the novel monstrosity made when it left the ground. He likens the din made by the wings and the wheels to a great rushing. Surely this suggests that this is an eyewitness account. The gods spoke to Ezekiel and told him that it was his task to restore law and order to the country. They took him with them in their vehicle and confirmed that they had not yet forsaken the country. This experience made a strong impression on Ezekiel, for he never tires of describing the weird vehicle. On three more occasions, he says that each wheel was in the middle of a wheel and that the four wheels could go on their four sides and turned not as they went. And he was particularly impressed by the fact that the whole body of the vehicle, the backs, the hands, the wings, and even the wheels, were full of eyes. The gods reveal the purpose and goal of their journey to the chronicler later when they tell him that he is living in the midst of a rebellious house, which has eyes to see and sees not, ears to hear and hears not. Once he has been enlightened about his countrymen, there follow, as in all descriptions of such landings, advice and directions for law and order, as well as hints for creating a proper civilization. Ezekiel took the task very seriously and handed on the instructions of the gods. Once again, we are confronted with all kinds of questions. Who spoke to Ezekiel? What sort of beings were they? They were certainly not gods in the traditional sense of the word, or they would not have needed a vehicle to move from one place to another. This kind of locomotion seems to me to be quite incompatible with the idea of an almighty God. In this connection, there is another technical invention in the Book of Books, which is worthwhile examining impartially. In Exodus chapter 15, verse 10, Moses relates the exact instructions which God gave for building the Ark of the Covenant. The directions are given to the very inch, how and where staves and rings are to be fitted, and from what alloy the metals are to be made. The instructions were meant to ensure that everything was carried out exactly as God wanted it. He warned Moses several times not to make any mistakes. And look that thou make them after their pattern, which was shewed thee in the mount. Exodus chapter 25, verse 40. God also told Moses that he would speak to him from the mercy seat. No one, he told Moses, should come close to the Ark of the Covenant. And he gave precise instructions about the clothing to be worn and the footwear appropriate when transporting it. In spite of all this care, there was a slip-up. 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 2. David had the Ark of the Covenant moved, and Uzzah helped to drive the cart it was in. When passing cattle shook and threatened to overturn the Ark, Uzzah grabbed hold of it. He fell dead on the spot, as if struck by lightning. Undoubtedly, the Ark was electrically charged. If we reconstruct it today according to the instructions handed down by Moses, an electric conductor of several hundred volts is produced. The border and golden crown would have served to charge the condenser, which was formed by the gold plates, and a positive and negative conductor. If, in addition, one of the two cherubim on the mercy seat acted as a magnet, the loudspeaker, perhaps even a kind of set for communication between Moses and the spaceship, was perfect. The details of the construction of the Ark of the Covenant can be read in the Bible in their entirety. Without actually consulting Exodus, I seem to remember that the Ark was often surrounded by flashing sparks, and that Moses made use of this transmitter whenever he needed help and advice. Moses heard the voice of his Lord, but he never saw him face to face. When he asked him to show himself to him on one occasion, his God answered, "Thou canst not see my face, for there shall no man see me and live." And the Lord said, "Behold, there is a place by me, and thou shalt stand upon a rock. And it shall come to pass, while my glory passeth by, that I will put thee in a cleft of the rock, and will cover thee with my hand while I pass by. And I will take away mine hand, and thou shalt see my back parts, but my face shall not be seen." Exodus chapter 33, verses 20 through 23. There are some astonishing similarities in old texts. On the fifth tablet of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is of Sumerian origin and much older than the Bible, we find virtually the same sentence. "No mortal comes to the mountain where the gods dwell. He who looks the gods in the face must die." In other ancient books, which hand down stages in the history of mankind, we find very similar statements. Why did the gods not want to show themselves face to face? Why did they not let their masks fall? What were they afraid of? Or does the whole account in Exodus come from the Epic of Gilgamesh? Even that is possible. After all, Moses is supposed to have been brought up in the Egyptian royal household. Perhaps he had access to the library or acquired knowledge of ancient secrets during those years. Perhaps we ought to query our Old Testament dating, too, because there is a good deal to support the fact that David, who lived much later, fought with a giant with six fingers and six toes in his day, 2 Samuel chapter 21, verses 18 through 22. We must also consider the possibility that all the ancient histories, sagas, and narratives were collected and compiled in one spot, and later found their way to different countries in the form of copies and somewhat garbled versions. The finds during recent years near the Dead Sea, the Qumran texts, provide a valuable and astonishing amplification of the biblical book of Genesis. Once again, several hitherto unknown texts mention heavenly chariots, sons of heaven, wheels, and the smoke which the flying apparitions emitted. In the Moses Apocalypse, chapter 33, Eve looked up to heaven and saw a chariot of light traveling there. It was drawn by four shining eagles. No terrestrial being could have described its magnificence, it says in Moses. Finally, the chariot drove up to Adam, and smoke came out from between the wheels. This story, incidentally, does not tell us much that is new. Nevertheless, chariots of light, wheels, and smoke were spoken of as magnificent apparitions as early as and in connection with Adam and Eve. A fantastic event was deciphered in the Lamech scroll. As the scroll is only fragmentarily preserved, sentences and whole paragraphs of the text are missing. However, what remains is curious enough to be worth retelling. This tradition says that one fine day, Lamech, Noah's father, came home and was surprised to find a boy who, judging by his appearance, was quite out of place in the family. Lamech reproached his wife, Bat-Enosh, and claimed that the child was not his. Then Bat-Enosh swore by all that was holy that the seed came from him, Father Lamech, and not from a soldier or a stranger or one of the sons of heaven. In parenthesis, we may ask, what sort of sons of heaven was Bat-Enosh talking about? At all event, this family drama took place before the flood. Nevertheless, Lamech did not believe his wife's protestations and, feeling very upset, went to ask his father Methuselah for advice. On his arrival, he related the family story that was so depressing to him. Methuselah listened to it, reflected, and went off himself to consult the wise Enoch. The cuckoo in the family nest was causing so much trouble that the old man accepted the hardships of the long journey. The question of the little boy's origin had to be cleared up. So Methuselah described how a boy had appeared in his son's family who looked much more like a son of heaven than a man. His eyes, hair, skin, and whole being were unlike those of the rest of the family. Enoch listened to the story and sent old Methuselah on his way with the extremely worrying news that a great judgment would come upon the earth and mankind, and that all flesh would be destroyed because it was sordid and dissolute. But the strange boy of whom the family was suspicious had been chosen as the progenitor of those who should survive the great universal judgment. Therefore he should order his son Lamech to call the child Noah. Methuselah journeyed home and told his son Lamech what was in store for them all. What could Lamech do but recognize the unusual child as his own and give him the name of Noah? The astonishing thing about this family story is the information that Noah's parents were told about the coming flood, and that even Grandfather Methuselah was forewarned of the terrible event by the same Enoch who soon afterward, according to tradition, disappeared forever in a fiery heavenly chariot. Does not this seriously pose the question whether the human race is not an act of deliberate breeding by unknown beings from outer space? Otherwise, what can be the sense of the constantly recurring fertilization of human beings by giants and sons of heaven, with the consequent extermination of unsuccessful specimens? Seen in this light, the flood becomes a preconceived project by unknown beings with the intention of exterminating the human race, except for a few noble exceptions. But if the flood, the course of which is historically proved, was quite deliberately planned and prepared, and that several hundred years before Noah received orders to build the ark, then it can no longer be accepted as a divine judgment. Today, the possibility of breeding an intelligent human race is no longer such an absurd theory. Just as the sagas of Tiwanaku and the inscription of the pediment of the Gate of the Sun talk about a spaceship which landed the Great Mother on Earth so that she could bear children, the old religious scripts, too, never tire of saying that God created men in his own image. There are texts which note that it needed several experiments before man finally turned out as successfully as God wanted. With the theory of a visit to our Earth by unknown intelligences from the cosmos, we could postulate that today we are similarly constituted to those fabulous unidentified beings. In this chain of evidence, the offerings for which the gods asked our ancestors raise curious problems. Their demands were by no means limited to incense and animal sacrifices. The lists of gifts required by the gods often include coins made of alloys which are specified in great detail. In fact, the biggest smelting installations in the ancient East were found at Ezion Geber, consisting of a regular ultra-modern furnace with a system of air channels, chimney flues, and openings for specific purposes. Smelting experts of our own day are confronted with the as-yet-unexplained phenomenon of how copper could have been refined in this prehistoric installation. That was undoubtedly the case, for large deposits of copper sulfate were found in the caves and galleries around Ezion Geber. All these finds are estimated to be at least 5,000 years old. If our own space travelers happen to meet primitive peoples on a planet one day, they too will presumably seem like sons of heaven or gods to them. Perhaps our intelligences will be as far ahead of the inhabitants of these unknown and as yet unimagined regions as those fabulous apparitions from the universe were ahead of our primitive ancestors. But what a disappointment if time on this as yet unknown landing place had also been progressing, and our astronauts were not greeted as gods, but laughed at as beings living far behind the times.